Hey everyone, Yas here, and I just wanted to say it's great to have you join me today because I'm sure we're going to have another fantastic episode. So whether you're here for the first time or if you're one of the repeat loyal listeners of the show, I truly appreciate you. But before we get to today's guest, I just have a small favour to ask, and that's if you could just take a brief moment to hit the subscribe button if you haven't already. Ensure that you share it with all your coaching friends, and don't forget to get in touch, guys. Let me know your thoughts on what you think of today's episode or any of the recent episodes you've listened to. You can do this on Twitter at The Coaches Net. Once again, that's at The Coaches Net. And please make sure you do, as I'd love to hear your thoughts, guys. Anyway, on to today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day, guys.
The Coaches Network.
Hey, guys. You're now listening to The Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Right, guys, welcome back to the Coaches Network. My name is Coach Yas, and I've got a very special guest with me today. My guest today is Danny Barham. Good evening, Danny. How's it going, man?
Yas, I'm really good. Yeah, another week in the football industry. We're on a Sunday now, so I'm always in good spirits. I'm living the dream, so I'm feeling blessed and I'm happy.
Amazing, and I'm feeling that energy as well, so I really appreciate you sharing that as well. Dan, just before we get into the thick of the conversation, whichever way it goes, maybe just a brief insight around who you are, what you do, and we'll go from there, man.
My name's Danny Barham. I've been working in the industry now for, this is my 12th season, or 13th season, one of the two. It all rolls into one in the end. I got into the industry at Birmingham City as a third year student. I did like an internship year in performance analysis at Birmingham City when performance analysis was in its infancy. And then as a part of that, I would just sort of start observing pre-academy coaching sessions of a Friday evening. And then that then turned into, can I lay the cones out for you? Can I take a technical practice? Someone's not coming tonight, Danny, can you take a session? And that was sort of my initial steps into coaching, especially from a professional academy perspective. I managed the university women's team that I was at prior to that, and did some sort of grassroots coaching prior to that as well. But they were that was me cutting my teeth into academy coaching. And then that experience turned into 4 years. And I always say this, and I'll probably say it two or three times through our chat this evening, is I've always been important. What's been important to me is developing across both paths equally of performance analysis and coaching. So that looked at that point like what would probably be best described as like a hybrid role, where I'm doing performance analysis for one age group and coaching with other age groups, not necessarily combining the skill sets within the same sphere and age group. That sort of come later in my journey. I then went, after 4 years at Birmingham, I did a year at Tottenham, and I was the lead schoolboy analyst there from 9 to 16s. And whilst I was doing that, I actually coached a non-league team in step 6 and step 5 of it was the Southeast Counties League, Division 1, a team called Punjab United. And that was really good because it gave me a really good opportunity of 11-a-side football, because a lot of my stuff that I'd done at Birmingham prior to that was sort of 9s to 12s type foundation phase pre-academy coaching. So that was a real good experience. And what was really good there was like it gave me my first experience of coaching and managing adults, some of them that have been like former Football League players that had sort of come to the back end of their career, highly experienced, just, you know, in their twilight part of their careers. And then after that year, I had the opportunity to move back to Birmingham. I'm still there now. This is my 8th season. And that started off as being the head of performance analysis and data for the academy, which was really cool, because data is in its it wasn't in its infancy there, but within an academy setting it was. So I was tasked with like building data-driven processes from a performance analysis perspective in the academy at Birmingham. And whilst I was doing that, I was coaching the 13s, 14s. And then, yeah, sort of fast forward 8 years, I'm the 21s assistant. I've had an amount of years. I've previously been the 21s assistant, and then I've been the 18s assistant more recently. This season, Mark Kennedy came to the club and asked if I'd like to come and sort of assist him in the 21s age group, which is really good because the club's moved to the Category One categorisation now. So it's the games program very difficult, facing really, really good opponents weekly, and that comes with its own challenges. But yeah, still got that same hunger and drive to better myself in the industry as when I did when I first started.
Amazing. There's so much in there in such a short space of time that you shared. I guess, let's start it. You said you started off by saying that you're quite passionate about developing yourself both as a coach and a performance analyst. You're right in what you're saying that, probably even as recent as 10, 12 years ago, probably wasn't necessarily in its infancy, but really started to make headway in terms of academy football in particular. I guess it's, it's a couple of years into the ECCC launching and whatnot. So just talk about that. How important has that part of the journey been for you in developing your coaching? Because I think traditionally what happens is with a lot of coaches, they're very, very fixed on, right, I'm just a coach. And I'm sure you'll agree, but there's so much value that having a background, whether it be performance analysis or whether it be something else, you kind of blend those expertise together, if you like.
Yeah, 100%. So where I feel the performance analysis stuff served me really well from two perspectives. The first was, the pure nature of the job in itself. I watched a high volume of games, and what you get as a performance analyst is you learn to see the game through the lens and the eyes of the coaches that you're working with. And I was really fortunate at Birmingham, the coaches that I work with, and then when I went to Tottenham, the coach that I work with there were they're highly regarded people. It doesn't surprise me since then that point then people have gone on and done really, really good things in the industry. So when I did my Advanced Youth Award, John McDermott, technical director at the FA, spoke around that his own coaching journey. He speaks around the importance of being on the shoulder of giants, so like learning off the shoulder of really, really good people. And performance analysis does that for you really well. Gets you in the door. I've sat in when I was at Tottenham, the under 18s FA Youth Cup preparation with the coach that was there at the time is now a Premier League manager. So it was a really, really fruitful experience, these types of things. And now the other side of it. The other side of it is it gets you exposure to what it gave me exposure to there was the 11-a-side game, because I always did like 16s to 18s performance analysis. But then because my coaching was always in the foundation phase, it allowed me to have a grip on where the players that I'm working with currently and I'm working with day to day on the grass, where have they got to get to as well? I think people talk a lot about the importance of seeing a cycle of players through and a program. That accelerated that for me because what I was able to do was piece the jigsaw together a little bit and go, okay, I'm practicing day to day as a coach in the foundation phase and youth development phase, but I'm seeing where they need to get from 16s to 21s. And that was really, really fruitful for me as well. So that was, yeah, that was really good. But the biggest thing was the high volume of games that I had to analyze and go through. It was, there's no substitute for that. And if I was to describe one of my strengths now as a coach, it would probably be my sharpness of my eye on the side of the pitch to go, the opponent have just changed this. They're now doing this. This is the implications for us. I often get complimented on how well I can see them game moments are evolving, and whether that's fixing it myself or encouraging the players to find a solution, at least I know and can see the problems, which I think is sometimes taken for granted.
I was just about to say that I think sometimes it's an underrated skill, isn't it? That observation piece, and I guess if you like the art of noticing what's going on in front of you. It's not just, and I think this is where I guess the performance analysis stuff comes in. It's that you get the opportunity to observe it, but you also get to create meaning out of it as well, which I think a lot of coaches do maybe struggle with at times, and you know, especially coaches earlier on in their journeys. And it's not necessarily even whether they're not even working in academy football or not, but sometimes they, you know, they're too kind of tunnel vision into what's happening in front of them. They're missing the bigger picture. It's something I talk about a lot, and it's that sometimes just take a step back. Don't worry about intervening or interacting. Just observe, because actually a couple moments of observation could actually open up the solutions that you need. Because you can better identify what the problem is in front of you. So I guess, you know, just taking it back to your journey a little bit in terms of that, you know, you mentioned there a couple of times about watching loads of games. So just talk us through that process. And what does that look like for you in terms of, you know, how do you start that process? Where do you begin with your observations? Because I think there is often a lot of messages shared, a lot of guidance given or advice given to coaches that want to develop their skill sets and their ability to observe the game. And I guess just your general knowledge. And it's, yeah, you've got to watch more football, you've got to watch more coaches, you've got to deliver more sessions. Now, those are very common answers, if you like, but it's not that straightforward in terms of, that's not really a strategy, is it?
I know what you mean. You'll learn this about me as when I'm talking, I will find little metaphors and crowbar them into the story I want to tell. But I'm good at bringing it back around at the end, so don't worry where I'm going to go with this. So that process that you're describing, I also you spoke around. You started this podcast to get a lot of spare time through lockdown. My lockdown thing was learning Spanish. And the process of learning a second language when you're not immersed in it in the lang in the country is a lot of try and fail, try and fail, try and fail. And I liken that to the process of getting your eye sharper through watching games. It's you at the start of the journey. Just like at the start of the journey of learning Spanish for me, when I'm practicing the language or when I'm practicing watching a game, I'm coming away going, I've just done an hour's language exchange or I've just done 90 minutes worth of a game. What did I take from that? Not a lot, because what I didn't have at the very start of either journey was any meaning, any mental models to link things together. I always liken it to the day it snows in England. You go out and you roll your snow in a garden and your snowball gets bigger. But you have to start somewhere. Your snowball starts really, really small. But the bigger it is, the bigger it can get. And that is like that process of learning a second language or learning the to train your eye to see things in the game. It all comes from just starting, because in between the games that you watch, you might have some conversations and that might, you know, trigger some things to, oh, actually, yeah, I saw that in that game I watched 3 weeks ago. And then you watch Monday Night Football and someone's talking about something there and it all starts piecing it together. The biggest thing is just going on the journey, just continuing on the journey. When I was one of the big things I always took from Tottenham when I was there, they spoke a lot about it's really important to help players believe in something that they can't see, i.e. the realizing the dream of becoming a professional football player. That is the same as it, the start of any learning journey for any person, in my opinion, that anything that's tough to do, whether it's learning the second language, whether it's becoming a Premier League football player, whether it's becoming really skilled at watching games back, you have to trust in the fact that if I stick at this process alongside having good conversations with good people, my eye will get sharper, because what you start to form is mental models in your head of, okay, they're doing this. And you start to see schemes of, you know, they're trying to do this. You see commonality in, I don't know, maybe it'd be a pressing trigger or it might
It almost
be
becomes a bit of a trend and a pattern that you observe, right?
100%, 100%. It's really, really interesting. So one of my favorite coaching books is a book called Coach's Guide to Teaching by Doug Lamov. And within it, he talks about there was an experiment with chess grandmasters, okay? And if you flash a chess board up to a chess grandmaster, and the pieces are actually placed in positions that are representative of a real game of chess, they will then be able to come back to you and go, yeah, that piece was there, that piece was there, that piece was there, that piece was there, because they've got their mental models. And I think we could do that as coaches or people that develop their eye over an amount of time. We'd be able to go, the fullback was on the last line, the winger was inside the pitch, the nine was stretching play, they built as a back three, it was offset to the left, these types of things. You'd be able to see them and say them quite quickly. What he also said was, if the pieces are scrambled and they don't actually represent a game, or a game of chess, they can't recollect where the pieces are, because, again, it comes back to this idea of having a mental model in your mind, a schema in your mind, these patterns like you referred to. But you only get them through deliberate practice. Now, deliberate practice for reading the game is watching the game.
100%. You know, I've actually got Doug's book, and I've had him on the podcast before as well. I spent some time with him, and you know, it comes back to that representative practice of, you know, within your sessions, right? If you're putting randomized drills together or practices together which don't represent the game, then it's hard for the players to have, you know, recognize the transfer of that practice into the live game and connect those dots, so to speak. You know, and I think one of the things you talked about as well is about that almost that continuous development piece. And it's something that I've kind of not undervalued, but probably appreciated more and more over the last couple of years, because I started martial arts recently, I said a couple of years now. But and the common thing they say is, like, you know, the black belt is the same as the white belt. The only difference is the black belt's been doing what the white belt's been doing for longer, i.e. he's still learning.
Brilliant.
So I think it's a great way to kind of frame it. And it's almost going back to the chess analogy as well, there's no, you know, they've got that picture, the grandmasters have got the picture, and they can recall the picture. There's no guarantees as to what's going to happen on the other end next, but that's almost, if you like, a moment of the game. And if we can become better as coaches, and I talk about this all the time, like recognizing that although there might be different potential outcomes off the back end of this moment, if you understand the moment and how the principles link into that, then you should have a very, 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 I guess, you should be able to develop a quicker ability to, you know, to solve that game moment in that situation, or at least counteract what's happening in that moment to kind of put it together. And it's almost like I always say to people, like, you know, if you're going to coach a session, don't just coach, as an example, just passing, right? Even if it is down the unopposed end of the spectrum and it's more technical based, then you can still create context. And I think that's the key. You've got to develop context. Where does this apply itself? Because a 10-yard pass, me playing to and from you, is not the same as a 10-yard pass with the context of us saying, right, how will we play 10 yards to the right and 10 yards to the left versus 10 yards forward? I think every little bit of detail counts. And maybe that's, you know, maybe that's a bit of my bias talking there, but I think it is important for coaches to recognize that out of context, it just probably doesn't serve a great benefit for the players. It's just doing stuff for the sake of doing stuff. And I say, you know, I've got a viewpoint and an opinion that actually, if we are going to go down that technical aspect and of the spectrum, and not to say there's any rights or wrongs, but I actually have a belief that actually it's probably best left to the experts, because they can actually contextualize how to utilize this within the context of the game. Yep. Whereas the novice, the newcomer, or even, and this doesn't just apply for players, but even coaches, is like, if they don't, you know, the argument is, well, they need tools to be able to play. Well, okay, yeah, but if they don't understand where the tools fit in, is it worth teaching them the tools? Yeah. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
It's really interesting. So I'll never give a straight answer, Yaz. So you'll either love it or hate it. But when I bring it back to my journey, so where my development into the industry, the initial part of it was my undergraduate degree didn't really have much coaching theory and research underpinning it. I then done my master's in performance analysis, and then all the coaching qualifications that I've done have been through the FA, and I'm most recently got on ECAS, the Premier League coach education course, which is fantastic. But what I'm trying to get at here is, when I talk to, I can talk to some, for want of a better phrase, novice coaches that have studied coaching, the actual art of coaching and the science of coaching, which is what you're getting into there. And they will blow me out of the water with their knowledge base of this stuff and what theory is best utilized to understand this practice or this practice or this practice. And I'm trying really hard because I've come from a different practice of performance analysis. I think I understand the game and see the game, but then the coaching context. But regardless of any of that, although I can't explain the theoretical underpinning towards the practice designs that I choose, which some people might say isn't good enough, you need to know, I would always lean to practice that is representative of the game, regardless of any theory. And that hasn't really come from anywhere other than it just makes sense to me. It like, and that's why it is. So people might watch some of my practice and go, you know, that really fits towards this theoretical underpinning. This guy must really understand this stuff. And I don't. I was heavily influenced at the start of my coaching journey. One of my mentors, if you like, when I first joined Birmingham City, was a guy called Sam Wilkinson. He was heavily influenced by the work of John Cartwright. I don't know if you've ever come across John Cartwright's work, but he was a bit of a coaching maverick and very ahead of his time. And he would talk a lot about like designing practice that's representative of street football. And he was beating this drum a long time before, you know, theory come out to really understand what is being said. But so that is probably a little bit of an influence as to why I coach in that way. But you know, I couldn't really tell you the theory behind it. I'm on the process of learning that stuff. But like, yeah. I say, there'll be some real novice coaches that could articulate that stuff better than me. But what I do think is important, and again, when Sam Wilkinson and John Cartwright used to refer to this, whenever I would speak to Sam, I met John once. It's still important. The practice design is important to bring around representativeness to the game, but you still have to accelerate people's learning through helping them and helping them with what they see, helping them with what decisions might look like in that point. Not removing the decision from them, still pushing them along, because, you know, players can play within or practice within representative practice that really aligns to the game, so they get real relevant pictures. But you don't know what you don't know in life, so they still might be making poor decisions with poor technique in their moments. So I think it's still the job of the coach, I feel, to make sure we push the needle on what they're interpreting in that moment, what they're seeing. And again, this links a lot back to Doug Lamov stuff that you referred to there. So yeah, it's triangles, and we're linking all the points of the triangle together. It all falls into one place, really. Yeah.
No, there's a few things you've touched on, and I think, you know, the first part is about, you know, that really resonated with me is similar to yourself. You know, at one point, at least anyway, I couldn't necessarily give you all the science or backing of the theories and all that. But what I did realize when I did my master's, I was just reading loads of different stuff, thinking, I already do this. I just didn't know there was a formal name for it, right?
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting. And obviously, you know, linking into what you're saying there around, you know, I guess in some ways, really, and I completely agree with you, if I've understood it correctly, that we can't just let the practice do its job and or let the game be the teacher, so to speak. No, but I fundamentally believe it. It sounds like you do too. That no, the coach still has to be the facilitator of learning in that situation. And yeah. I think this is where probably you've seen a massive shift in the last maybe 10 or so years, where, again, I'm not saying this is the case, but I do question sometimes, do coaches coming through now, whether, you know, because of the structure or the system in place or whatever their education might be, do they really even have the capacity, the competency and the knowledge to even be able to coach the game and be a facilitator of that learning outside of just letting the game be the teacher, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think we definitely saw a phase of people hiding behind let the game be the teacher. It's probably a poor strapline in reality, because that isn't, and I imagine whoever come up with that strapline probably would say it was a misinterpretation. But the what you said there was really key. It was the facilitator of the learning. I wouldn't want anyone to misinterpret my practice by listening to this without watching me and think that I'm pausing the practice at every given moment and I am telling, or there is a, by the way, telling gets a real bad rap. Like explicit feedback gets a real bad rap. There is more than a place for explicit feedback to then I'm really fortunate with the under 16s assistant coaches, a real skilled PE teacher, and we'll talk teaching a lot, and he'll send me a lot of like papers on explicit feedback. It's got another name. He'll tell me off for calling it that, but it's got another name. But it's essentially just telling. And the analogy we always say is like, you wouldn't hand your car keys over to someone without a driving license and say, go and experiment. Let the car be the teacher. Like, it's not going to happen, is it? You need you, there's a place for explicit feedback. But coming back to the point I said, when you sit around the facilitator of learning, I'm sure this is stuff that people have talked around on your podcast before, Yaz, but like use of constraints to, cleverly guide players towards outcomes. And is really important. If you can be really skilled with your constraints, you can bring about what you want within your practice, and your practice design is really important to bring about what you want. I mean, again, bring it back to my performance analysis stuff. It's a really good part of my learning that I had. So one of my tasks as the YDP performance analyst, I used to have to come up with what was called a coaching syllabus video weekly. So whatever the YDP coaching topic was, I had to make a syllabus video that would show best practice examples of whatever it is that's going to be practiced happening within the professional game. And then what I got in the habit of doing is then when I'm designing my practice, I would look at the action, what actions are happening, and then I think, what practice design can I come up with that's going to organically allow that to happen without it being me being the person that's telling them to do that? It would be, my telling comes from the telling in ways of, this is something you should see in this moment, more so than I want you to turn at this specific moment. I think the game provides the opportunities and the affordances for players to
Yeah.
decide when using a technique. I've used
Well, I think
turning there.
the information is there, isn't it? And I think, it's a challenge I always have to coach. What have you coached today? And so, oh, yeah, I coached scanning. All right, brilliant. Go on, tell me more about that. Oh, yeah, I was getting them to check their shoulders and whatever. Okay, is that what scanning is? Is scanning that, or is actually scanning just the observation of information that's on the pitch in front of you, right?
100%.
And there isn't a specific biomechanical action that links itself to scanning. Although we often hear coaches say, check your shoulders. Actually, what happens if everything that I need to see is already in front of me? I don't need to check my shoulders. But
100%.
then some coaches would then potentially berate players or even critique players on the fact that they didn't check their shoulders. Well, I didn't need to. And you can't tell me what my peripheral vision's like, right? But at the challenge that I often have to coaches is, all right, oh, you've coached scanning, but have you told you, you know, you might have given some insight on how to potentially do that, whether I agree with that or not. But have you told them what to scan for? When to scan for it, and what might be a valuable variable to consider, and what might not be in each given moment. And I think this goes back to, the earlier point that we were talking about in terms of, of being able to observe the game, notice what's going on, and recognizing that fundamentally, whilst the variables will pretty much stay consistent in every situation, they present themselves very differently. And you've got to think about not just how they present themselves, but how they present themselves, and what does that mean for the I guess the opposition player and the individuals that they've got, as well as the individuals that you've got on your team, in terms of the profile of the players and how that information then again represents itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. And that's for the skill of interpretation. So like we're talking about this like representative practice, what it does for technique as well. So like I think there's a misconception around technique being, just clean passing and receiving, ball striking. But again, a guy much cleverer than me when it comes down to this coaching theory stuff is actually our goalkeeper coach at Birmingham City, Dan Tomty Bevan, and he does a lot around, you know, representative practice from a goalkeeper perspective. And what he would discuss from like a how he would explain this from like a coaching outfield stuff is if you do, you know, I don't know, classic passing diamond type practice that you might see, just passing around the outcome. Because the variables are so slim, what players get good at is practicing that one passing technique. But then when the ball is, you know, bobbling up, you know, to halfway up their shin in as the ball's coming in, which how do they practice that if you always practice under clean circumstance? I thought that was a really good analogy. You know, it's they the only again the triangle, we're linking everything back, like whether it's my learning or your learning or the player's learning. That it's there's no shortcut to this stuff. You know, you just have to do your time doing it. So if you practice over an amount of years playing the game in various forms, with it, with intentionality driven by the coach, probably, you will practice the techniques that the game require very regularly, but just in different forms. Just like when I'm saying, you know, I become sharp at watching the game through watching the game. I wasn't watching the same game every time. I was watching a very different game every single time. The represent my repetition wasn't coming through watching El Clasico a million times. It was watching El Clasico, then watching Friday night championship football. Then, you know, I'm taking a non-league team in step six. Then the next, you know, earlier that day, I'm watching a under 16 category one game. That's where my skill set was developed through the variance. And that, and again, success leaves clues. That why wouldn't that be the same for player technique or player scanning? You know, it comes from being placed deliberate practice with variation, essentially.
Yeah, and I think there's a great point there. And I think one that I've kind of read in between the lines there, and it's something I talk about a lot as well, is that with every concept that you look at, there's going to be some objective variables, and objective variables meaning they're they're independent, they just don't change, right? So whether that's passing the ball, whether that's shot at a goal, whatever that concept is, there's going to be some things that every single player does in that. So I think my advice to coaches, often in terms of when it comes to observing and becoming better at noticing things, is right, what stays the same? What is consistent in every player's technique? Because it's not going to be the same right throughout, but it's not going to be completely different right throughout either. So what can you notice that stays the same? I.e., I don't know, it's the point at which they strike the ball. It's the placement of the non-kicking foot, like all of these factors, right? And they start to develop an observational framework which gives you a range, like what could it be, what can't it be before it gets unsuccessful and successful, if that makes sense. And then slowly start to kind of filter out, right, what is consistent, right, brilliant, what changes now, and how do those changes then, I guess what outcomes do those changes lead to if they are changing, whether that be, right, we still managed to score, we still managed to get it on target, okay, but what was the flight of the ball like, what was that like? So coming back to your example about doing a diamond practice, if you like, I often think, we talk about talk a lot about multitasking, right? Like people say that multitasking is this thing that we can do, but actually we can't. So it often is referred to as task switching. So you're never actually fully focused, and because you keep switching the task, you're never actually fully immersed in the task that you're doing. But if you go through a repetitive, unopposed practice or whatever it might be, you might go into a mode of routine, and you kind of you're semi-focused in it, but your focus quickly narrow it quickly drops. So one thing that I've trialed in the past and I thought was quite effective, and it really worked for the players that I work with, was instead of having that diamond, or it might be the diamond practice as a base, if you like, but actually it might be, right, for the first six passes, Danny, you're gonna play to your right, then you're gonna play to your left, then you're gonna play ahead, we you know, I'll get you some repetitions of each one so you understand the concept of that. But actually, the next six, you're not allowed to do two of the same in a row.
Yeah, so there's always variation within it.
But you're still in control of the decision.
Yeah.
But the constraint is you can't use the same one in a row. Now, it automatically focuses you on having to recognize those little variables that I've talked about, right?
Yeah.
In that, right, who am I going to play to? Why am I going to play to them? And we can have those conversations and me being, I guess, a facilitator of learning and that to explore and, I guess, unravel that decision-making process as to what led to that decision, what didn't lead to that decision, and look at all the other things within that. It's an example of what you could do personally. Again, I would always try and veer into the world of, right, how do we create more representative practice? So coming back to your earlier example about watching the game and looking at that moment and that, the actions that can, the actions that are taking place in that moment of the game, and then kind of extrapolating that and putting it into some sort of practice, which then replicates that, but not with you having to tell them this is what you're doing. But actually,
Yeah.
the situation is just designed in a way where actually, well, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because that just seems like the natural and organic thing to do, right?
Yeah.
Little things like if a player's through on goal and it's been played down on the left-hand side, well, why would you not strike it with your left foot? You might
Yeah.
want to strike it with your right, you might tend to bring it back, but actually you're counteracting the opportunities that the situation has given you.
Yeah.
And again, it reminds me of like the martial arts. I do jiu-jitsu, and one of the things I always talk about, like whatever technique or whatever attack you want to go with, understand that you're going to leave yourself exposed somewhere else.
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
just the way it is, right? So if I go for you and I want to grab this side, then okay, that side might be loose for me. So if you react quick enough, you can get that side. So it's again, it's that intuition and that art of noticing, right, what's happening. And it's going back to your chess master analogy or your grandmaster analogy, that there will be certain patterns. There is a
Yeah.
yin and yang to almost every situation, and it's how quick can you read the yin to understand what the yang could be, right?
Yeah.
And that so a lot of the coaching that I do when I'm working with players is very much exploring that piece. So that, yeah, again, it was a bit of a ramble there. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
No, I like it. I like it. I like what you sort of you brought variations. So we use the passing diamond as a figurative practice that we've sort of co-designed here while we're talking. But we both know what each other means. And then you've added variance in it by sort of putting a constraint on the practice. I would do a lot of. I've just sort of termed them sort of dynamic pass and receiving practices. Now sometimes I'd have interference along it, so I'd have two groups practicing the same thing within the same area, but not you don't always have the numbers for that, so it wouldn't always be that. But just again, nothing that anyone's not done before. But I would be, and the reason I do it is the rationale that you're talking about. So they're practicing passing and receiving as a skill, but they're getting lots of variation of that within the moment. And if it's got interference against it as well, there's also a third optic to observe that is semi representative of pressure in the game. It's not obviously real pressure. You can only do that by doing a pose based practice. But so what that might look like is rectangular area. And again, depending on how bigger or smaller you want the passing technique to be, you might be considering things like physical load, and where they are, your players are within the training week, these types of things. It would just be maybe a player at each end, three players in the middle, and they just have to work the ball from one player to the other end player, and everyone has to touch it or something like that. And I'd use a lot of coaching points that would be I'll talk about just try and get in flow, try and get in the flow state. Like that, I'm not really talking about like that granular detail of your first touch has got to be here or here or here. It's like if you're opening yourself out, make sure you can get to your next pass, or if you're setting the ball, make sure your teammate can walk onto the ball like with his next touch. But don't kill the momentum of the passing and the receiving that's going on. That like them types of things. You'll be surprised by giving a constraint that just like that, placing an idea like that, don't kill the momentum of the passing and receiving practice, where players feel a degree of responsibility for the quality of the practice that's going on. And that just naturally brings about good practice because it just does. But within that practice, players are receiving or perceiving ball coming to them from various distances, passing over various distances. It could have an amount of combination play that's two player combinations, three player combinations. I wouldn't have the two end players stuck on the ends either. Like once they've played in, they might step into the practice. Someone else has got to recognize they've got to step out of the practice to make sure it's balanced. It's like there's very few rules on it. Just play really nice football, and if you give that as a constraint, that they will pass, they will pass, they will receive with quality. They've got the constraint of don't mess up, because Danny's said don't mess up, play good football, and you'll be really surprised if you do practice like that how good they look. And when I say good, it's like not good in terms of clean either necessarily, like good in terms of it has probably more relation to match tempo. You always hear when people are doing like more repetitive drill-based practice, you always hear people go, you shouldn't be making errors here because it's unopposed, or it's simple. You're only passing 10 yards. You're making lots of errors. You hear people say these types of things. I think there's something within practice engagement because the task is too easy. And that people might listen to this and say, well, that's the responsibility of the player to then take more care in easy practice. But I don't know. I think your practice has got to stimulate people. If it doesn't stimulate people, one thing, again, coming back to my storytelling and my metaphors, really, really interesting bit of learning that I'd done on ECAS. So the first workshop was in the lakes, and we had to abseil off of a cliffside, or I don't know if you define it as a cliff, but yeah. And
How did you find that? I did it as well.
you did it as well. You know what? I was good, but it was really interesting. Before we did it, I'm sure you're the same. There was like a, what are the implications of this task? And it's like some people will be like really, really deep in thought and like thinking of all the eventualities that could go wrong here because they're scared of the task. The other end, you can have people that are so laissez-faire about what's going on, they're not that bothered, that they actually make errors
That's probably
because
me.
it does, it does, yeah, because it doesn't stimulate. Well, we had one guy on it, great guy. He actually ended up going upside down because he just wouldn't really listen to the instruction
Heard
and stuff,
about
because yeah, because he was just so easy with how he felt about it.
It almost became
Too
loss
easy
of
to,
focus, right?
yeah,
Yeah.
you lose focus because of task engagement. And again, it made me think about like that type of drill-based practice that should be simple but has lots of errors. Is it got lots of errors because players aren't good enough to do them, or has it got lots of errors because the practice isn't engaging enough? And then that had like
Yeah,
fur.
but also within that, I think there's also, sorry to cut you there, I think also
No, you're
within
right.
that there's a piece around recognizing whether the lack of engagement that comes from the fact that the players or coaches in this case aren't able to connect the relevance of this.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think that's certainly, it was something that I found with, with players generally, we talk about player engagement a lot, and how do we get it? Well, I've got a phrase that I like to use, which is relevance drives engagement. If I don't understand why I'm doing it, I'm probably not going to do it.
Yeah, 100%.
And even if I can recognize that this might be a slightly easier challenge or easy challenge for me, if I understand the relevance of it, I might appreciate it a little bit more, and actually give it more concentration, effort, and focus. So I guess, it's really interesting. But just to take you back a little bit, then, you mentioned obviously ECAS. There'll be many.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting, confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. With the new Ace line, looking effortlessly sophisticated this fall is easy and comfortable. Stock up on crazy cozy sweatpants, shorts, and sweatshirts that elevate your style. They even have blazers, if you're lucky enough to grab one while they're in stock. Mack Weldon balances classic pieces with updated details to keep you looking sharp, not flashy. Just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MacWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MAC25. That's MacWeldon.com, promo code MAC25.
Coaches listening to this, I've got no idea what ECAS is. Maybe just build a little bit on that and how you've gone into being selected for it, but also how you found it so far. And I'm sure there's some bits that we can cross over on.
Yeah, no problem. So ECAS, I think, means Elite Coaches Apprenticeship Scheme. It's run by the Premier League, and essentially it's, you know, a Premier League driven initiative to improve, you know, the standard of coaching within the country, and develop more expert coaches. And then the selection process for that was, you know, I had to apply formally through my head of coaching to recommend me, and then I had to apply, and then I had to go and interview. I've actually, this is the third time I went to get on the course, and so I got it on the third time of asking. It's quite competitive, and yeah, really fortunate. I've got a really, really good cohort of people that I'm working with, the coaches that I'm working with, and what I love about the course is the coach educators aren't from football. So they are just looking at it in terms of the purity of what does science say about coaching or whatever task it is, because it's not all about actual just coaching. It's actually built to be wider than just your practice on the grass, where like a traditional A license might have done that or a B license might have done that. The ECAS is like developing your professional skill. So an amount of it is, you know, grass-based coaching in terms of training sessions and games, but also, you know, that there was a recent workshop on challenging conversations, which is a big part of our roles as practitioners in the industry, you know, being able to navigate difficult conversations with different stakeholders, be that players, co-workers, you know, the hierarchy within a club, parents, maybe these types of people. So that was cool. Like I said, that, you know, people would have maybe listened to us both talking about abseiling off of a cliffside and going, where does that link to football? But for me, the analogy that I spoke around, like the implications of coaching practice, were understanding people will react based on challenge point, and people's challenge points for different tasks will be different. Based on challenge point, people's engagement in tasks can be, you know, have too much fear going into a task or not enough fear going into a task, and these, or not enough engagement or too much engagement going into a task, which can either inhibit or help their ability to do the task.
Just the perception of the task, not even the actual reality of it, if that makes sense.
100%. So it was really interesting, that piece around, like, so the next day after abseiling, we had to climb, wasn't really a mountain, but it was very, very, very steep hill. And then I knew I'd be fine with this task. I knew I'd be fine. So we had to pair up. So what I'd done was, to ensure that I wasn't the guy that's abseiling and falling off, I tried to partner myself with someone that I knew would need my help a little bit. So I did that. But what that done is it allowed me to, it that then brought the task difficulty higher for me, because now I've not just got to get myself up the hill, I've got to help someone else and mentor someone else up the hill as well. But now what I'm doing is that extra bit of bandwidth that I've got towards concentration or task engagement, that if I didn't have it, I would have probably been a little bit lapsed and maybe made some errors. That sharpened my focus, because I've now got to get someone else up this hill as well. But then that had implications where I thought, like, what might that look like? You know, if you've got a high achieving second year scholar playing in a FA Youth Cup game against, you know, maybe an academy of a non-league team, for example. And for him, he plays up in the 21s, Cat 1 games program all the time. He might be going, this game's far too easy for me. How can you set them other challenges aside from the actual football to make sure that they don't have a bad performance?
Yeah, just don't get complacent, right?
This is it. Yeah, like how else can you manage that extra bandwidth that someone might have towards a task?
I think it's really interesting because a lot of what you're saying resonates with me, because obviously, you know, we were up there at the same time with different groups, of course, but I probably had a very similar experience. And I think I walked away from the couple of days that we had there, and I felt like I don't think any single one of the tasks actually stretched me. And you know, I think it probably gave me a little bit more, like you said, focus on actually does every task need to stretch you, or does it, you know, is it okay sometimes just to be okay with it? Like, do you know what I mean? And obviously there's an if you know, we were there for 3 days, we've done about five or six different tasks or whatever it was, but you know, probably if it got to maybe day four, five or six and I'm still feeling like I'm not being stretched, I probably would have switched off. So it did give me a lot to think about in that respect. But you know, similar to what you shared, you know, I early on I realized, yeah, I'm not really gonna be fazed by any of this. You know, if you gave me the choice and I knew it was going to be safe and nothing was going to happen to me, I'll probably jump off the side of that cliff by myself. And I wouldn't think twice. But in doing it, I think one of the key takeaways for me in particular, especially when I did the abseiling one, is when after I was done with it, I was thinking, ah, oh, man, maybe I could have taken my time a little bit more and just really soaked it all up.
Yeah, enjoyed it a bit more.
Yeah, just enjoy it a little bit more. And it doesn't, you know, and going back to, you know, what you're saying about the performance analysis stuff and watching the games and observing, actually, maybe I could have found some meaning in it. Do you know what I mean? So it gave me a different perception in that respect. And then I guess the follow-up for that was similar to yourself. I found it very quickly that, oh, actually, probably I'm not really going to be stretched by this. So what can I do to support the others in the group? And I found that was quite interesting. And I think one of the key takeaways, and it sounds crazy to say this, but actually just asking others, you know, what can I do to help you? Like, what do you need from me? And because, you know, sometimes as coaches and just as people generally, we assume that we know what's going to help, but actually that might put the person off even more, right? And sometimes no help is what they need. They just need presence.
That's it.
So yeah, there was a lot of things for me to reflect on, and I guess my question linked to that, then, you know, what would you say like your biggest takeaways were from those three or four days that we were there?
Everything that you've just said there really, really resonates with me, even down to the stuff around like the type of support that you might give someone in a different situation. And as we're talking now, I'm conscious, like, there'll be people listening to this and like hopefully they can join the dots and then just see it as me and you talking about our experiences on a course, but like join the dots between the implications for that is, you know, how do you best support someone, you know, that could look like how do you best support a player, but it also might look like how do you help another player understand how to best support a third player. And then when I had all the experience you had, it's probably a third moment that was really pertinent for me on top of all that, which was we had to climb up a waterfall as well, which I loved. But that was the only one that caught me off guard. It never caught me off guard at any point of it, apart from, so I'm a contact lens wearer, right?
I got halfway up the ledge
and I got loads of water in my eyes, and then I couldn't see anymore. And the task quickly went from a walk in the park and I'm really enjoying the views here to I'm on the edge of a cliff here. Now listen, we've got all the safety equipment, but if you slip, you're whacking that face and it's going to hurt. So like it very quickly went like I had to focus myself really quickly into I've lost one of my senses now. I now just need to navigate this through just using my hands. I can't actually look for where am I going to put my hand now. And again, that had implications for football for me. So there'll be games where, do you know what? I had one with the 21, my very last game, actually. We played Leicester. We were 1-0 up within inside 3 minutes, scored off a set piece. And then they hit back and scored within 2 minutes of that, an error from us, from like a, our fullback got his throw wrong. It's undercooked. The striker's nipped in front. They've gone through one and one with a goalie and scored, right? And then all of a sudden, the players have gone from the highs of this game is, you know, we're 1-0 up inside 3 minutes. Not easy, but, you know, we're going to do okay in this game, to, uh-oh, the final score, we'll lose 6-2. But when I look at the game, I watch the game back, there was nothing tactically that caught us out. The techniques of that game weren't beyond the players that we had. What happened was all one big psychological game for them. It was they were unable to do what I had to do in that moment, and that was, this is fine and I feel fine, and it all of us very quickly become not fine, and I need to refocus myself to get myself out of this hole in some way. They didn't have the mental capacity. Now, that's easier to do as an individual, because you've just got to rely on you to try and get you, and you maybe don't need all 11 of you to come on the journey, but if you the law of average, you've got to try and get 6 of the 11 to bring the other 5 on board, in a game.
Get the majority on board and the minority follow.
100%. Like, they weren't able to do that. And again, a lot of my coaching post that game was, you know, you talk about practice design, like, a lot of small-sided games, nothing really too taxing from a technical or tactical point of view. But what I would do would put high consequence on the games, like five rounds of games. And I would talk, my players say I'm very good at, you know, I'm like the Eddie Hearn when I'm training. Like, I'm selling the fight every time it's just, you know, five rounds of 6v6 mini games. That's all it is. But I'm really good at bringing the fire to the practice to try and make it feel like the game. And there was one, so there was one team that were 2-0 down, so it's best of, so it's five games, so it's best of three, so if they lose one more, they're done. And I'm saying, you're now at Leicester, you're 2-0 down in the games, and when I'm looking at your body language, when I'm looking at your behaviors as a group of players now, you know, I don't actually see you winning the third game, because you got no one cajoling. You got no one coming up with a strategy. You got no one.
Becoming a follower rather than anyone stepping up as a leader.
Exactly. And then what you've got is the other team. When things are going right, it's really momentum. Such a beautiful thing in football. Yeah. Like, for the other team that 2-0 up, they're like, they can't wait. They're foaming at the mouth. They can't wait for the third round. And then, so is the implications of that. But again, like, I think with this course, and it sounds like you've got a really similar experience with your future coach developers you're on, isn't it?
That's right,
It's, you make the meaning yourself. On things like that, you make the meaning yourself.
Yeah, I think, you know what, there's a lot in what you just said that resonates with me. And I think, you know, the first piece is, you know, you talked there about being a contact lens wearer, right?
Yeah.
And I remember being at the top of that little cliff bit myself, and I went up the side that they said was supposedly, not intentionally, just because I actually wanted to go the other side, but I ended up going this side because I was next in the queue, and it was like, yeah, go on your turn sort of thing, right? But I actually wanted to go to the other side because they said, oh, that was going to be a bigger challenge. So yeah. I wanted the bigger challenge for myself. Anyways, I got up to the top of this one, similar to yourself. I do wear glasses, but I don't wear contacts, so I didn't have my glasses on that day. I'm fine without them. I got to the top, and all I had was just bloody water coming in my face.
Yeah.
Just like in my face, to the point where I never felt like I was at risk at any point, if you like. But for a brief second, I couldn't breathe.
The
water was just like literally just coming all over into my face, and it was just like I literally could not get a breath in. So I almost had to kind of, like you said, just for me, I just kind of looked down, gathered my breath in, and kind of looked back up. And by the time I looked back up, it was starting again.
So
just on around a second. But then it got me thinking, like, just about what you said, like, about being a contact lens wearer, right? Unless I know that about you, unless I connect with you and build that relationship, I'm just assuming, right, he's just not performing.
He's not
performing. And I think you got me thinking, like, you know, the number of times where actually when coaches are working with players and we just make assumptions on what they are doing, what they can't be doing. But going back to the earlier point around how best to support, actually, how much do you know about your players and what manifests for them when they are under pressure? Like, how does it look? How do they physically look when they are under pressure? How do they look when they're calm? And to the point where you're not just making assumptions on those things, but actually, you know, like, for instance, for me, I'd say, generally speaking, I probably deal with pressure quite well. It probably doesn't show that much, but if I am feeling quote unquote stressed, if you like, or under pressure, I probably just go quiet, because now that's almost my mechanism for trying to realign my focus.
Yeah.
But again, if you have to get to know the individuals, right? And it's so important. Like, you know, I guess I'm thinking about it now and reflecting later on. Actually, probably, yeah, one of the biggest probably reflections on that was like, well, how well do I know the people around me and what they need? Not because I think that's what they need, but because that's what they're telling me they need. And even if it isn't necessarily what they need, let's start with that, because that might open the door for us to find out what the best solution is for them. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, like you said earlier, you don't know what you don't know. They're really going to be able to exercise the solutions or the strategies that they are aware of. And maybe going back to the whole concept of being a facilitator of learning, actually, can we explore some other solutions with them? So again, there's so much in there, and I think it's just, you know, it's just brilliant to kind of just reflect on that experience and just really understand that actually, you know what, there was a lot of learning. It might not be technical, tactical, like your A licenses and whatnot, but actually, just from a psychosocial standpoint, they just understanding how to better be a better leader and be a better teammate, if you like. Like, there was so much to gain from that, and you know, I kind of, if there's anything that coaches listening to this now will take from that, it's just like, how well do you really know your players?
Yeah.
Like, how
and the
well
other thing on
actually...
that, Yaz, is like, yeah. that's dynamic in itself as well. So like, you might know them today, but something might have happened over the weekend that means you don't know the most important thing that's going on with them. And so it's like, this has all got like links and implications across the board. Like, so is the most important thing knowing your player? Like, again, I'm using metaphors. Like, is the most important thing knowing the game, right? Or is the most important thing having the relationship for when the player's situation is changing, you are able to find out relatively quickly what the new issue is, the new dynamic issue is, and how that is solved. And then again, come to the right side. Is the most important thing knowing the game and seeing a game problem and solving the game problem? Or is the most important thing knowing the game problem, but also empowering your players to dynamically solve the game problem? Just see what I'm saying? So like, the point I'm trying to make here is like, the link is dynamism. It's the ability to be dynamic within a situation. And I think that's a real key skill for coaching across, whether that is your interactions within your work setting, whether that's your interaction with your players, your interactions with the game. It's like, I can know everything about this player, player X, but then the most important thing is having a dynamic relationship with them, so that when that changes, I can now know the new problem, not just knowing them at a point in time. Just see what I'm saying?
The problem is just, 100%. Even if it's not knowing the problem itself, it's recognizing or being in a position where you can recognize actually there might be something changed in this dynamic here. But even going back to something you said earlier about, you know, is it knowing the game or is it knowing the individual? And I think it's probably both. It's probably both. And what I mean by that is, if you know the individual and you know the game, then you can probably bet. And I guess if you've got that information in terms of where the individual is in this moment, it's up to you as a coach then look at that and say, right, how does the game change based on that?
Yeah.
So today, you know, typically we want to play this way, whatever way that might be. And typically, if we want to play that way, then we require X, Y, Z from our players. But today we haven't got X, Y, Z. We've got A, Y, Z. So how does that affect how we want to now play the game?
Yeah.
And I think if you look at it through that lens, because I guess it's just profiling of players as well, right? You know, coaches listening to this, everyone nowadays seems to have a game model, a way they want to play, but actually, how often do they really consider the profile of the players they need to make that work? You know, and what that then looks like in terms of if you've gone from having, I don't know, a central striker who's great at holding up the ball to a central striker who likes to run in behind. Like, the whole system has to change now. The whole process has to change. You might have some key principles that you want to still follow, but actually how it then presents itself will fundamentally be different based on each given moment of the situation, right?
100%. And that's the point I'm really trying to make there. It's like, it all comes down to your dynamic capabilities as a coach. So it's whatever the problem is that you're faced, be it on pitch, off pitch, dealing with individuals, dealing with the environment, dealing with managing up. It's how dynamic you can be in any given moment to bend and change. And I'll give you another example of this. I love telling this story all the time. Like, I'm not talking about any one individual here or any, you know, there'll be a million stories of this, but you'll see that, right, there'll be coaches that have maybe coached at a Cat 1 Academy and they've had the best players all the way through the development pathway, right? They don't have to be dynamic necessarily. They do to a degree. I'm doing them a disservice. They don't have to be as dynamic as what other coaches might need to be. But because they've got a sexy badge on their CV, they then sometimes land themselves maybe a Football League coaching job further down the, because they're not going to get a Premier League job necessarily, but maybe somewhere further down. And then when they've gone from having all of the raw tools to that lends itself to a certain game style and getting success with that certain game style and always having the best players, to then now not having them raw tools, and they often stumble on the ability to be dynamic. Whereas, like, I am going to talk about my own education, but there'll be loads of coaches that will resonate with this. Like, I love the Cat 2 Games program, because you'll go play Burnley or Brentford, and or Swansea, and you're in a real football game, and then you go and play, I don't know, you know, there's lots of times I don't want to be derogatory towards anyone, because I'm not being derogatory. I love their programs, but you know, you'll face a real direct style of football. And through the course of a Cat 2 season, your players get faced with a lot of different game styles. And then as a coach, you have to learn to become really, really dynamic. And as a coach of a Cat 2 under-18s team, over the period of 3 or 4 years, you might have 3 or 4 different profile of strikers, because you know, you're not getting the pick of the best in the country. Whereas what's going to be really effective at Cat 1 and winning every single game, that type of striker, okay, yeah, here he is, I can pay money for him, brilliant. But that doesn't breed dynamism in your coaching.
You mean you almost become spoilt, where you become less resourceful in that respect.
But it's not their fault. It's not their fault.
A victim of the circumstance they're in, right? And I think it's a really good point to raise and talk about, because there'll be coaches listening to this thinking that it's all bells and whistles when they get to the top, right? Or when they get into academy football. But the reality is they're going to be dealing with a whole bunch of players with a whole different, set of profiles, and probably working for a club that actually doesn't have the money to go out and just buy someone to fit the way they want to play.
Yeah.
So I think there is definitely pros and cons in it. And I guess what you're saying, I guess indirectly, is it doesn't matter what level you're working at or what players you've got, you still got to be able to coach.
100%. 100%. You got to... But that's the art, like, and that's, I said at the start of the call of the podcast here with, you know, I'm really fortunate, just finished another week working in football, feel really, really fortunate. And that's what it is. It's a never ending, I call football two things. The industry is a never ending Rubik's Cube, because you're never ever going to fix it. And the game itself of football is the most complicated game of chess ever. Because you've got moving parts that have got their own emotions, feelings, decisions that they want to make. They're two things that I hold true. Is like, the industry is the most difficult Rubik's Cube. It's an impossible Rubik's Cube to solve, because it's always changing. And the game itself is the most complicated game of chess that you'll play, because it's, you know, it's not just, you know, a horse that you move around. It's got feelings, it's got emotions, it can move, it can do what it wants. So yeah,
I think there's just something, there's a couple of different points that you raised there, and it's just got me thinking. Like, the first instance is that coaching can look very different depending on the environment you're working in. I always say there's no one right way to coach, other than the way that works for the individuals that you're working with. But also, I guess, you know, the underlying message for me and what you've said there is, look, you just got to keep trying to get better. You've just got to keep working to trying to get better. And you know, better doesn't mean the best. It just means better than you were maybe in the previous interaction. And sometimes, and I think this is the bit that I guess a lot of coaches, I think, struggle earlier on in their journey, and I guess it comes with time and maturity and experience. It's okay to get it wrong.
100%, yeah.
It's okay to get it wrong, and I think sometimes, you know, we have to get things wrong and be able to reflect effectively on that to recognize how to get it right. But like you said earlier, like, no two games are the same. You're not watching the same game over and over. Every situation is going to be different. So, and linking back to what I said earlier, like, what are the consistent variables that you can control?
Mm-hmm.
Now, can you get to a point where you start to understand what you can influence and what you can't, and then learn to kind of accept and be okay with that?
Yeah,
like, you could come out with the best game plan, and you know, everything can go well, and you know, the opposition have just got, I don't know, a goalkeeper who's just on some different type of, you know, situation today where he's just saving everything. Like, it happens.
Yeah,
like, there's literally some games, and you know, as frustrating as it might be, there's, you know, you can't really do anything else. You've done everything you could.
Did you, Yaz, have, did you, on your experience in the Lakes, on your course, did you have Sam Jarman?
Yeah.
The philosopher. Now, listen, I loved it. But you know what? It was beautiful because we were sat there talking and like, we went on the experience with him, and he's basically said at the end of the workshop, anyone that doesn't really want to carry on can go, and anyone that wants to can stay. Half the group got up and they were like, weren't having that at all, walking off. The half that stayed for an hour and a half and would have stayed for another 3 hours. It was so divisive in terms of, do you love it or like, was you taking it or not? But where I'm going with this, so for people listening, Sam Jarman is a philosopher, and he spoke on the course around, you know, a lot of introspective thinking around, you know, what's the meaning of life? Like, who are you? What are you as a human being? And basically, why I think he was really important to the weekend, or the 3 days that were there, it wasn't even a weekend, it was midweek, was what you said there around, you might have a goalkeeper that saves everything and he's on a different standard for that day. As a coach, you cannot tie your success to the outcome of 22 random people doing random things. You cannot tie your success to that. And I think this is why you get a lot of people that really, really struggle with things like mental health at the top end of the game, like the stress, and you know, it really cripples people, and people, you know, it's actually like a very abusive relationship. You talk to a lot of like ex-Football League and Premier League managers that they talk about loving it and wanting to do it again, but they also talk about how much they dreaded games and stuff like that. Like when you really delve into it, it's because they are, and listen, we're all competitive beings. Like they're really wedding their sense of being to the outcome of a game. So I think it's a real dangerous place to be, or the outcome of whatever your outcomes are as a practitioner, whether it's, you know, developing players, like getting professional contracts as an 18s coach, or getting debuts as a 21s coach, or whatever it is, getting signing 10 players as a pre-academy coach, whatever it is, you can't wed your sense of
achievement and success,
yeah,
or value, yeah, even, yeah.
Yeah, to an outcome that you cannot control.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, and it goes back to what I was saying a few moments ago, right? And that just, you can only control what you can control. Like, mm-hmm. if soon as other people's decisions come into it, influences and thought processes come into it, like you have to relinquish some of that control and recognize that actually you're not the sole I guess, sole decision maker in this process right now. So as much as it is about, you know, being able to, I guess, if you hit those KPIs of getting a certain number of players, contracts, certain number of players into the first team, debuts and all the other stuff in your case, you've got to accept that sometimes it's just not going to happen because the manager's got a different opinion.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You know what, you know, you see it all the time where one manager comes in not having it, next manager comes in, all of a sudden there's four or five players that are getting an opportunity or vice versa, right? So I think it's really important. I think going back to being able to control your own outcomes and control your success, but that, I think, like you said, it was quite divisive. I'll be honest with you, it was probably a bit more one-sided in our group.
Really?
I think probably it was about 14, 15 of us that everyone just left.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was quite interesting. I think maybe it probably the time of the day that it was in, probably people didn't really have the bandwidth to really take it on board and really absorb it. Which I definitely think would have played a part. But again, it goes back to that piece earlier, right? How do you keep things relevant for the audience? And yeah. I think that, you know, coming back to the audience, you know, I'm curious and I'm conscious of time as well. You know, if you were being able to reflect back on your journey now, and maybe not necessarily offer some advice necessarily, but just reflecting back, you know, what would be some of the most useful takeaways for you in your journey? Like, you know, you've talked about loads of different things, and I'm sure there's a shitload that we probably ain't even got around to covering. And I definitely, you know, encourage and love to come back again to kind of explore that. But you talked about, you know, the importance of performance analysis and that you know, that being part of your origins in your journey. You talked about the importance of being surrounded by coaches that you can kind of learn from and, you know, pick up their way of viewing the game. And you've mentioned about being, you know, effectively reflective for yourself and recognizing that actually, how do I develop? You've talked about not necessarily having to have the underpinning of the theory and all of that linked to it, which I completely agree with all of the above, by the way, because I think it's important that it's not necessarily just about understanding, but actually can you apply it? And sometimes mm-hmm. applying things, and it goes down to this thing around professional judgment, right, as well. Like sometimes we just can't explain it.
Yeah,
but our experience tells us this is the right thing or this is the right way to go about doing it. And I speak about that a lot because, you know, it's probably slightly different to yourself in that started off as, you know, probably with similar ambitions to you in terms of coaching, but then gradually fell into the space of coach development. I've kind of been hooked by that really, really ever since. And like one of the questions I'm constantly wrestling with and I'm just fascinated by is, well, how do coaches learn? What's the best thing what works for coaches?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the things that's kind of emerged for me is that there isn't a right way, but we have to be better at understanding what ways it maybe exist.
Yeah.
And I guess linked to that, then, you know, what are some of the key learnings for you up to this point in your journey where you think, do you know what? I wish I knew these one or two things like earlier on. And I probably could have added a lot more value earlier on, not necessarily because it would have helped you progress your career. Mm-hmm. But I actually just think you've been more effective as a coach in the get-go.
Okay. So my take-homes would be, what would I want people to leave and go, do you know what, that was really good? I love, there's a Jay-Z quote that just says, the genius thing that we did is we never gave up. I love that. Like, when I look at, when we talk about my Spanish journey, my journey of getting better as a coach, my journey of getting better at reading the game, all of it is just a process of not giving up. There will be some really, really low points, 1,000,000%, but the sun will shine the next day. Like, get back on the horse, just go again. Like, I can't tell you the amount of drummings I've had on the side of a pitch, like, that really make you second guess, is this something I want to actually be doing? But some of that philosophy stuff around, you know, don't wedge your sense of achievement as a person to outcomes necessarily. Now, that gets misconstrued a little bit as well. Like, that sounds like there's a lack of ambition. I'm telling you, I've got the fire. Like, I want to get better. I want to go to the top. That's what I want to do. But, you know, that doesn't mean... I just think it's a better way of dealing with the adversity that is an inevitability in the industry. So that stuff around, like, the just staying on the journey, just doing the work, just keeping getting better is so important. That's massive for me. I can't stress that enough, really. And then I'm semi-conflicted with this because I read a book recently. It's like I forget the name of the book. Oh, it's a really famous book. Oh, how have I forgot the name? It doesn't matter. But essentially, the key theme of the book is around like it's a bit of a fallacy that you choose the work that you enjoy and you just follow your passions. You know, you've got to do work and build up enough career capital to then do the stuff that you enjoy. It's really going to wind me up that I don't know the name of the title of that book. There'll be someone listening to this going, that's the title of the book. That's the title of the book. But it is what it is. But the other side of that is I like to tell the story. I once got asked a question in a job interview, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? And they hated my answer. I know they did. But my answer was this. I can't tell you what job I'll be doing in 5 years' time, but I tell you now the job, the roles and responsibilities that job will have will be these things. I love delivering to players in a classroom, so I'll definitely be doing that. I love coaching on the grass, so I'll definitely be doing that. And when I say coaching on the grass, I mean planning my own sessions and delivering them, because there's some academies that give session plans to coaches. I love designing game plans for teams, so I'll definitely be doing that. I love individual player development, so I'll be doing that, right? What they wanted me to do is go, yeah, no, I'm really ambitious. I want to be a first-team coach in 5 years. So I know loads of first-team coaches that are doing first-team coaching roles just to say they're coaching a first-team. The roles and responsibilities that they've got are not the roles and responsibilities that they set out at the start of the industry to be doing. Now,
Or that fulfill them right now either.
Exactly. Now, the wage might fulfill them. The title might fulfill them. But again, this links back to this philosophy stuff, the Sam Jarman stuff around like, where do you derive your sense of achievement from? For me, it's doing work that I love and enjoy. And I won't easily give that up. Mm. So when I talk about like, where will I be in 5 years' time? I'll be doing a job that enables me to do that really, really well, because that's where I derive my sense of happiness from, is doing that type of work.
I think you're spot on, and it just reminds me of that old saying, right? You know, if you do work you enjoy, you'll find you never do a day of work in your life. And I think it just goes to that, like, you really have to enjoy it. And I think the more and more I came into this journey as a coach, been coaching for 16 years, but actually probably the last 6 or 7, I've probably really prioritized coach development.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just love it. I'm just fascinated by it. Yeah, it's not even about necessarily seeing coaches get better. It's just actually just enjoying the conversations and the different challenges coaches are facing. And, you know, if I can help them, then great. If not, then we, you know, can we just learn from one another at least?
Yeah.
And I'm just fascinated by the idea of how coaches learn and develop. And, you know, if there's any small part I can play in them, then fantastic. And, you know, one of the things that always stays with me is that, And again, I've mentioned this before in the podcast and in conversations with people, but I remember it probably about two or three years into my coaching journey or coach development journey. And like, we'll have this conversation today. Like we might not see each other for X amount of time, but we've had a conversation, we've had some interaction. But then what happens is what this used to happen. I used to think it was quite weird, if I'm being honest. But I'll meet these coaches, I'll bump into them at some point and I'll be like, oh yes, how's it going? I'm still thinking about that thing that you said. And I used to just think, oh, you lot are weird, man. Yeah, but I'm still thinking about what I've said, like. But then, as time went on, and I guess I got a bit more mature, and I started reflecting. I think to myself, actually, no, that's probably exactly what I need to happen. I need you to be thinking about the things that we've discussed. It doesn't have to be something I've said specifically, but actually, what it taught me was, one, you never know who's watching.
Yeah.
Two, you never know the influence you can have on people without it even being shared with you.
Yeah.
I remember just recording a podcast a couple of days ago with someone, and I thought I'd met them like 2 years ago, but it turns out I met them 6 years ago and they came to my first ever CPD event.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, wow, like, I would never have known that
if
you hadn't mentioned it. And I just thought, like, the influence, the, you know, the observation, the people watching your journey and whatnot. And it's just like, actually, so what it taught me more than anything was that Right, okay. If we don't know how we could be influencing people, we just have to be a bit more deliberate and intentional about what we're doing. Because actually, if we're influencing people subconsciously or unconsciously, imagine what we could do if we were conscious about it and the messages that we
Cool
can leave
thought.
behind, right?
No, it's a cool thought. And the other thing on that, Yaz, as well, like that might just look like providing a space for people to talk through ideas for them. You know, you might just be the catalyst as a coach, developer, coach, educator to ask inquisitive questions and provoke thought within them that helps elicit something. Because, you know, with we'll go back to the ECAS thing when I was in the lakes. You know, I don't actually really remember any of the coach educators setting out and saying, I really want the players to arrive at these outcomes, that the players, the coaches to arrive at these outcomes of learning. But everyone went away and derived their own meaning and learning from that. And we've, you know, this is the first time we've ever spoken in depth, and we've both come to some real similar learnings based on it, and we're reflecting on them today. But that was just through providing a space and providing an ability for people to reflect and make their own meaning from something. And that might just be the powerful thing that you do. It might not be something that you might not even necessarily be a bit of advice. It might not even necessarily be an action or, you know, a bit of feedback around a practice design or anything like that. It might just be giving them the space to reflect and you know, order their own thinking.
I think you're spot on, and I think again, it's not about being. It's not for us to decide how the value's been added. It's just for us to have the intention to add the value in the first place that is going to make the difference. And I think, it's just got to be deliberate and intentional more than anything else.
No,
Dan,
it's cool.
it's been a real pleasure, man. Again, loads of insights shared and loads of things that we kind of explored there. And I'm sure there'll be plenty for the listeners to kind of tap into there. And just even myself, just resonating with some of the thoughts that you've had and I guess the experience that you've had, not just through ECAS and but just in your journey generally. And I hope that I wish you all the best in your journey. I wish we cross paths again and hopefully connect again for a part two, because it's been a really fascinating conversation, man.
Yeah, as I again just come back to what we said there, when we talk about like providing a space to reflect, you've definitely done that for me today. So I really thank you for that, and been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, and I hope the people listening have been able to take some things from this. I'm big on like helping people, so people reach out to me. I'm happy to give advice. I'm the guy that ends up, you know, speaking to someone randomly on the phone and getting them a job somewhere because I've got a link, and I'm just really passionate about helping people. I think speaking to you tonight, Yaz, it feels like we've got that in common. So yeah, I really appreciate the work that you do, and you know, the help that you give the space to, you know, with you know, bringing your guests on and giving people content to listen to, because I think it's really important that we all drive the industry, because we only get better if we all try to get better. So thank you.
I really appreciate that, Dan. Thank you again for your time, man.
Cheers, guys. All the best, mate.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.